This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett, the host of The Takeout, joined as I always am by the political director of CBS News, Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Major.
You know, all we do at this show is create new firsts. We are in an exciting period of development for this show. The audience keeps growing. And we have yet another first in episode 14 of The Takeout. We have our first presidential candidate joining us at the microphones, Carly Fiorina. Carly, thank you much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Not only do we have our first presidential candidate, we have our first vice presidential person to receive an electoral vote in the last election.
I had forgotten about that.
An oddity I wasn't even aware of until just a couple of minutes ago. That's actually pretty cool. A Texas elector chose you as a recipient of their one vice presidential electoral vote, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
How's that feel?
Well, I was very honored.
That's pretty cool. And as I understand it, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has memorialized that or has saved that electoral vote, and that's now being framed, and that's going to be part of your Carly Fiorina memorabilia kit, right?
I didn't know that either.
I have to come here and talk to you to hear all these breaking news. Always.
Sounds like you might have ruined a surprise there, maybe.
Exactly. Well, we're full of surprises here at The Takeout. Carly, thank you for joining us. We're going to talk a lot about the president, where the administration is. I want to start that conversation, though, with something that was said by you March 9th, 2016, in Miami. I'm sure you remember the day very well. Let's roll that soundbite and use that as a way to talk about what you thought about Donald Trump then and how you are praising his presidency now nearly 100 days in. Let's listen to that soundbite.
Now, you know, there are other people in our party who actually are kind of horrified by Donald Trump. I'm one of them.
You were then horrified. Are you now?
Well, you know, he is our president.
Mm-hmm.
He won. Right. And so now I think it is incumbent upon all Americans, but particularly those of us who are Republicans, to hope for, pray for, help him succeed. My concern back in March, and frankly my concern today, is I ran for president because I think there's too much money, too much power, too much decision-making based in Washington, D.C. My concern was that that system would continue. That remains my concern. And so, for me, success is that power and money and complexity and decision-making leave Washington, not remain concentrated in Washington. And I actually think that that's a very nonpartisan comment. There are all kinds of Americans who hope that. And Republicans and Democrats alike have participated in the concentration of power.
And when you look at the Trump administration so far, what is it in specifics that concern you about either him falling prey to this concentration of power or the money? Or make you wonder if he will fall prey to it?
Well, first, I think he's done some things that give me great encouragement. It gives me great encouragement to say we're going to freeze federal government hiring. It gives me great encouragement to say we're going to start slashing through the thicket of regulation that has built up over 50 years. It actually gives me great encouragement when Steve Bannon says things like we're going to deconstruct the administrative state, because that's what we have, an administrative state. On the other hand, I will say that I was disappointed that Republicans, I think, made the same mistake that Democrats made when they were focused on health care. Democrats made a huge mistake, in my opinion, by passing Obamacare on purely party lines. You can't make major changes to something that impacts every single person's life without building support for it. And I think Republicans have made the same mistake, trying to pass it quickly in 3 weeks on purely party lines. And unfortunately, they didn't convince the American people that where they wanted to take them was better than where they are.
Steve?
Next Saturday, we're going to be inundated with 100 days appraisals of Donald Trump's administration. Mm-hmm. What grade would you give the president at this point in his administration? What are you seeing? How would you grade his management of his administration at this point?
Well, first I have to say, I think the 100-day mark is always foolish.
With you, by the way.
I mean, I think it's arbitrary. I think it's silly. I think it fails to recognize the complexity of the situation, point one. Point two, so yes, many articles will be written, and I won't read very many of them, honestly. Point two, I think it's important to remember that the concentration of power and money and complexity that concerns me and most Americans, frankly, has been going on for 50 years. So it's a big undertaking to start to take that apart. Number three, I tend to think about leadership in particular ways. Leadership to me starts with solving problems, challenging the status quo. And so I think the test of this administration will be, are problems solved? Clearly, he has challenged the status quo. Clearly, that's why he's in the White House. That's why he won the election, because the American people said, you know what, we don't want more of the same. We need change. We need somebody who's going to actually challenge this system.
And you, well, I was going to say, you know, you were highly critical of him during the campaign. After the election, you had said some very nice things about him. You called him a champion. Are you seeing glimmers of hope aside from, is there anything specific that you're seeing, I guess, already in his administration that offer you glimmers of hope? What specifically have you seen, and what have you seen that troubles you?
Well, champions win. He won.
I was comparing him
to Kobe Bryant at the time. Yeah. But so here are things that I think he has done that give me great hope. First of all, I supported the strike in Syria. It was long overdue. There was a message that needed to be sent to that regime, as well as to that regime's allies, that there are certain things we cannot tolerate and we will not permit. I think he handled that extremely well. I am encouraged that I think there is a growing realization of the role that Russia actually plays. Russia is a bad actor. Russia is not our ally. Russia is not our friend. Russia is disrupting the Middle East, and we're going to have to reassume a posture of leadership in the Middle East. I am encouraged in the way that he is dealing with many of our allies and our adversaries alike. So all of that encourages me. And as I say, I'm encouraged very much by his focus on tearing apart this regulatory thicket that no doubt is costing this country jobs and growth and opportunity. I'm disappointed in health care. I wish he would take on tax reform quickly. It's the single greatest lever to grow the economy. And I think an infrastructure program could get bipartisan support. By the way, it's fair to say I've been very disappointed in the Democrats as well, because they're simply refusing to play ball, and that doesn't help the people.
Carly, we build this takeout podcast around a meal, and it happens to be the lunch hour, and we are at Station 4, an elegant restaurant near the waterfront in southwest Washington, D.C. We are delighted to be here. Olga is our waitress. Carly, please order your lunch, and then I'll do the same, and so will Steve, and then we'll take you all to break and bring you back for Section 2 of Episode 14 of The Takeout. So,
yes,
Carly,
it is
like
a lovely restaurant. I've never been in here. I'll come back. So, Olga, I think I'm going to have the beet salad, please. Thank you.
Elegant choice, Carly. Very good. I'm going to go much more lowbrow with the short rib grilled cheese sandwich and the duck fat fries. Okay, that's just right down on my
gutter. And you're going to do it all on camera. It's so impressive.
I'm going to split the difference. And in honor of your home state and a place where you lived for a long time, I'm going to get the California grilled chicken, and I'll go with the duck fat fries. Is that what they're called? Duck fat fries, yes.
And how about the Supreme Court, Carly? That was a huge issue in the campaign.
And it's a huge win.
It was the event that, upon witnessing it, I thought was, at that stage of the Trump presidency, the most presidential event he put together. And there had to be some furniture rearranged according to Senate rules, but it happened. And how significant is that, do you believe, for the conservative movement, for this presidency, and for the high court?
It was a huge win. It was extremely well done. And it is an example of why I say I think the Democrats are behaving in a way that is not serving the people's interests. I mean, it was absurd for Democrats to say, we're going to filibuster this justice. In essence, what Chuck Schumer said was, I don't like him because he's conservative. I don't like him because he's pro-life. My goodness, how many people, how many Republicans have voted to confirm Supreme Court justices with whom they disagree? So the Democrats went to a new low bar when they basically said, I think they absolutely will live to regret it, because now, of course, the next Supreme Court vacancy will really tip the balance of the court. Justice Scalia's seat was a conservative seat. Now the next one up, we're really talking about the balance of the court. And now all you need is 51 votes. I think the Democrats are going to live to regret that. But I also think it's worth noting that basically their reasoning was, yes, they were mad about Merrick Garland. I understand that. But their reasoning was, we don't agree with him. Therefore, he is unqualified. Wow.
We're going to continue our conversation about politics, policy, and lots of other fun topics with Carly Fiorina, the first ever presidential candidate to grace us here at the Takeout Podcast. We are at Station 4 Restaurant in Southwest D.C. on the waterfront of Washington, D.C. I'm Major Garrett. You're listening to The Takeout.
Over the past 18 months, North Korea has conducted two unlawful nuclear tests and an unprecedented number of ballistic missile tests, even conducting a failed missile launch as I traveled here for this visit. The era of strategic patience is over.
That's the voice of Vice President Mike Pence when he was in South Korea, part of a 10-day trip throughout Asia to confer with and reassure American allies in that region. Welcome back to The Takeout. I'm Major Garrett, joined as I always am by the political director of CBS News, Steve Shigaris, our special guest this week for episode 14, Carly Fiorina. Carly, during the presidential campaign, you and I had a lot of conversations, and you talked at great length in the debate formats when given the opportunity about national security, your perspective on that. So I want to bring up, before we get into some lighter fare for our conversation, some kind of heavy stuff, which is North Korea and Iran, both very heavy issues, weighty for any president, weighty in particular for this president, because he has clearly signaled through the Secretary of State, the Vice President, and others that what worked or didn't work for previous administrations will not be tried anymore. We are going to deal with North Korea differently. How do you assess the signals that this administration is sending, and where do you see that heading?
I think the signals are absolutely correct. I think the Obama administration was weak on foreign policy and was perceived as being an administration that would respond to no provocation, because they didn't. And when America is weak, bad things happen. Chemical weapons get dropped and Ukraine gets invaded, et cetera, et cetera. So the signal is absolutely right. And I think the words that Vice President Pence chose were very appropriate. The era of strategic patience, whatever the heck that means, is over. And what he was signaling is what's appropriate, that we're not just going to let North Korea continue to launch missiles and test nuclear weapons. Sorry. We don't need to be any more clear about what that means. I think the signal has been sent. And so now Kim Jong-un has to calculate differently about the risks. I also think it was entirely appropriate for the administration to begin a review of the Iran deal. The Iran deal, I said it all during the campaign, I will say it still, the Iran deal was a bad deal. Even if Iran is meeting every letter of that deal and they're cheating around the edges, that deal does not safeguard the region. It does not provide consequences of any kind for Iran's continued state sponsorship of terrorism and disruption. So I think the signals have been very appropriate.
When it comes to North Korea, one could also argue, as Secretary of State Tillerson did this week, or at least implied it, by saying, you know, we're going to review the George W. Bush administration decision to take North Korea off the list of state sponsors of terrorism. That was done in hopes of placating the regime.
That's right. And it didn't work.
And it didn't work.
It didn't work. Those six-party talks didn't work.
You know, so it is. I take at face value your criticism of the Obama administration, but the Bush administration went through a lot of efforts
that didn't work.
That came to nothing. The Clinton administration.
That's right.
Sent Madeleine Albright there.
That's right.
Witnessed a grand parade in Pyongyang. So lots of administrations have tried to cut this Gordian knot. And it seems to me this administration is trying to signal confrontation is a real option. Is it actually an option, though, when you think about the fact that conventional weapons can be fired from North Korea and destroy homes and apartments and condos and human beings in Seoul, less than 40 miles away from the DMZ?
Well, I think it's a long way from legitimizing the North Korean regime, which is what Clinton did. It's what George Bush did to a certain extent. Obama just tried to ignore them. There's a lot of distance between legitimizing the regime and confronting the regime militarily. I think it is appropriate that the Trump administration will not take military action off the table. They shouldn't. We never should. But I also think the signal that's coming out of the administration now is we don't view you as a legitimate regime. Your behavior is not legitimate. You will be isolated. We are not just going to stand by and tolerate this. And we are engaged in a very serious set of conversations with your very large neighbor to the north, China, upon whom you depend, to get engaged in a different way. And I think ultimately that is the solution here, for China to engage in a different way.
Before I give it over to Steve, do you think among the options, one would be a greater nuclearization of that entire region? Say to Japan and South Korea, look, if you want to go down that direction, go for it.
I don't think we should take that off the table. And I think there are, whether it is nuclear submarines to Australia or capabilities in Japan and South Korea, all three of those allies have been asking the United States for some very specific support in some very specific areas. Under the Obama administration, it was not provided, and I am presuming that it is an open question and on the table in the Trump administration, and I think that's appropriate.
What do you say to critics of how President Trump is handling the North Korea situation, who think maybe he's being not diplomatic enough? I know diplomacy, at least in his view, has not worked over the last several years. But there are some people who feel that perhaps we're whipping up the emotions of a guy who's unstable, who's running North Korea, and anything could happen because of this. What is your reaction to that criticism?
I think that's a fair criticism. I think diplomacy over Twitter is a really bad idea. And I think there are times when ambiguity and unpredictability are helpful, and there are other times when it's really important to be precise with one's words. I think it's important to be pretty precise with our words when it comes to North Korea, and particularly in Asia, where saving face is such an important part of the culture. I think there is a requirement to be very thoughtful and respectful at the same time that one is being firm.
So let me take this opportunity. I'm going to grab the ball from you and give it right back to you, Steve. But
oh,
this is really important, what you just said, about a couple of things. I'll get to Twitter in a second. But this week there's a conversation going on about what the administration should have said or missaid about the actual direction of the carrier USS Vinson and its attendant strike force. You don't just send a carrier, as you well know. You send a tremendous number of vessels alongside a carrier. It's eventually going to get to the peninsula or the strategic whereabouts. But it wasn't going there when the president said he was sending an armada. Is that a screw-up, or is that something that just falls under the general umbrella of President Trump operates A, differently, and B, likes a little ambiguity? And do you think that was harmful?
I don't think it was helpful. I don't think it was helpful. And I think it is helpful that the armada is in the area. I do think that sends a signal, but this, frankly, is an example of where precision in language actually matters.
And what about Twitter? Do you think, you said Twitter's not a good place for diplomacy, do you think this president is a little excessive on Twitter?
Yes, I think one has to say this. Look, I completely understand and support, although I'm not a fan of Twitter myself, but set that aside. That just may be me. I think when President Trump communicates directly with the American people, clearly the American people, a large number of them, really appreciate that. So Twitter has its place. But I don't think Twitter is the best diplomatic platform, shall we say.
So we have an experiment going on here at the Takeout, Carly, that I'd like to communicate to you, and you can encourage our audience to join in to the degree you think it's necessary. But the way we have set in motion kind of an old-school phenomenon here at the Takeout is to say, We have these takeout stickers, which you can see on CBSN when the cameras look at this right now. I sign them. It's a cool thing. You can put them on your laptop, your iPad, your car, anything.
Cool. Your head.
They're very cool. Yes.
Put them right here.
You can put them right on your forehead. They stick. They adhere very nicely. Anyway, the only way you can get them, though, is a very, very old school method. Mm. We do not accept email requests. We may in the future, but right now we're kind of rigidly clinging to the self-addressed stamped envelope phenomenon. And so far, we have received 11 letters with staff self-addressed stamped envelopes from Texas.
Four from Texas.
Myself an honorary Texan. My father was born in Baytown.
We had Schieffer on
last
week.
I worked in Amarillo and in Houston. One from my home state of California, one from Hawaii, one from Arizona, Virginia, one, Alabama, one, Massachusetts, one, Minnesota, one. So 11 letters, 8 states, 4 from Texas.
That's in 2 weeks, I just want to say.
So Texas is repping large here at the Takeout Podcast. And I believe, Steve, you have some viewer mail you'd like to share.
I do have one that I wanted to share. This is from Arizona, from Arizona, Ryan Jensen. I just wanted to read this on the air just because I think that, Major, you get a kick out of this. Ryan writes, my wife and I have become a fan of yours, Major, through watching CBS This Morning.
There we go.
This is super dumb, but anytime Charlie, Gale, or Nora say your name to bring you on, we both yell, Major Garrett, and do a salute. So I think maybe on the podcast,
wow.
Ryan,
I should start
I salute you.
Yeah.
Saluting you maybe every week.
Now, there is a martial aspect to my name, and we're going to get to the fascinating aspect of your name, Carly, and the Civil War history that lies behind it. But just so everyone understands, Major is my father's name, my grandfather's name. There is no particular military history about it at all. It is just a name passed down through the generations of my family with no particular military hook whatsoever. But I've always been glad to have it. It always brings some degree of attention. And I think you would admit, Carly, as someone who also has a slightly unusual names work. They are hooks to themselves, and people tend
to... Well, people remember.
People remember, people exactly, remember. For good or bad. And in my case, sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's bad. Now, Steve Shigaris will tell you exactly how you can obtain one of these classic Takeout Podcast stickers with my signature.
And please, send us a letter, too. We really enjoy
it. We love
reading
the letters.
Your comments, but if you would like your very own Takeout Podcast sticker signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
That is the voice of Steve Shigaris, political director of CBS News, and you are listening to The Takeout.
Fight is fun. Hey, I can, you guys know, I can land a punch, okay?
Boy, is that true.
It is fun, right? So it's fun to have a fight, and it's really fun to have a fight when you win, but to the point, now that we've won, it's important that we bring people along. Hmm. Why is that important? It's not just important philosophically. It's not just that. We have to persuade now for practical reasons.
That was Carly Fiorina at CPAC. The date, February 24th, 2017. She is our guest on episode 14 of The Takeout. We are at Station 4, an elegant and lovely restaurant on the waterfront in Washington, D.C.
Not to mention delicious.
And delicious. Oh. The food has arrived.
So
and,
good.
You know, it's hard to make a bad grilled cheese sandwich, but you can make an exceptional grilled cheese sandwich. And the short rib grilled cheese sandwich I am partaking of fits into that latter
category. I'm very
close
to just grabbing it off your plate.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
you
to
do.
Mention
amazing.
The duck
You do,
duck
and
fries.
there will be blood
Don't
flowing.
Be shy,
Don't touch my short rib grilled cheese.
You have to share the fries with Carly, right?
So, Carly, is politics about fighting only, or is it mostly about winning, and how do you decide which is more important? Because sometimes you can't always win, but you can still make a point.
Yeah, well, let me start by saying that 80% of the American people think that politicians care more about their position, privilege, and perks than on getting the people's work done. And 80% of the American people also think the federal government is incompetent and corrupt.
Are they right?
So, yes, they are.
They are right.
And it's
in
one
both
of the
senses.
Reasons I ran. Yes. Look, 80% of the people is everybody. And what people basically feel is that politics and politicians and government isn't working for them anymore. And they're right. politics shouldn't be just about winning, but unfortunately it has become too often all about winning. You know, George Washington in, I think it was 1798, gave a farewell address to the nation in September. And in that farewell address, he warned us about the rise of political parties. And he said the problem with political parties is they will come to forget about governing, forget about values, and get focused on winning. And of course, when you're focused on winning, the controversy is helpful. By the way, the media loves to focus on the controversy. So, you know, the extremes in a point of view fight it out. On the other hand, change, sustainable change, requires a critical mass of support. And that's a time when people have to come together and find common ground. So that's why I said several minutes ago that I was disappointed that Democrats passed Obamacare on purely partisan lines. It was a huge mistake on their part because that program never had the necessary support to survive. But it is equally a mistake when Republicans try and pass its repeal and its replacement along equally partisan lines.
Could the president make appeals to Democrats when he's at 37 or 39% in the polls?
Well, I hope he will, and I think infrastructure is an opportunity to do so. I mean, infrastructure development is actually a role the federal government is supposed to play, and there is supposedly bipartisan support for it. I think you could do some innovative things in private-public partnerships, moving money out of D.C. into the states. I am very disappointed, I have to say, that the Democrats have already declared that they're not willing to work on tax reform unless he releases his tax returns. Look, I think Donald Trump should have released his tax returns, but I'm also practical. I don't think he's going to. And so for the Democrats to take themselves out of that when they supposedly have had an appetite for tax reform for at least a decade, I think doesn't get the people's work done. It's once again all about winning, not about governing.
But what if the president were to say, look, okay, if that's all you're asking is the release of my tax returns, which something every American president has done dating back to Richard Nixon, that seems like a small ask, doesn't it?
Yeah, except it hasn't been. I mean, look, I'm not casting, I'm not making a judgment about it. I think he should have released his tax returns. I said so at the time. I think so now. But I, practically speaking, I think it's unlikely based on what we've seen so far. But what's even more important, by the way, I don't think most of the American people who voted for him care about his tax returns.
Not those who voted for him, those who did not do.
Yeah, but if a lot of people voted for him, he won. He won. Let's not forget.
The question is,
he won.
Is that an issue that moves voters is the question.
Yeah, I don't think it moves voters. I think the people who didn't vote for him had plenty of other reasons in their minds not to vote for him. So what I think the Democrats care about right now is winning. Tax reform is something about which there's been a lot of bipartisan appetite. It is the single most powerful lever to get the economy going and growing again. And so I wish they would take that up, both sides.
So you made a little news this week by saying that you are considering potentially running for the Senate in Virginia. My question to you is, somebody who ran in a state that was not very, let's just say, friendly to Republican candidates
blue,
statewide.
Deep blue.
In California.
In California.
considering running in a state that is becoming less, I think, friendly
yeah,
to
it's
statewide.
Purple, for sure.
But trending blue, it seems. I guess my question to you is, one, what are you sort of weighing as you figure this out? And secondly, what do you see the landscape for Republicans as they approach the midterms next year? There is some discussion, at least, of Democratic enthusiasm. We're watching these special elections very closely. Is that part of your calculus as you try to figure out what you're going to do next year?
Well, first, I've said for some time that I would consider that Senate seat. I've been encouraged to consider it. Frankly, I'm not going to make a decision for quite some time. And one of the reasons for that is because the Commonwealth of Virginia is having very important elections right now. We have a gubernatorial election, et cetera. I've endorsed and am supporting Ed Gillespie, and we have an important set of elections here to get through. With regard to your question on how Republicans will fare in the midterms, honestly, I think it has much to do with what gets accomplished. Mm-hmm. What actually gets accomplished? Are bureaucracies dismantled? Is power and money and decision-making moved outside of Washington? Is the tax code reformed and simplified? Does a health care bill get repealed and replaced? Is there infrastructure development? I think people want to see results, and I think Donald Trump won because people said, this is a guy who can achieve results. That's why I think Republicans have majorities in both the Senate and the House, and I think now results need to be produced. I'm hopeful they will be.
If, as Democrats hope, though, there is this anti-Trump sentiment that starts to build as we get closer to November of 2018 and perhaps an anti-Republican Congress sentiment, does that weigh into your calculus? Is this just about winning, or are you considering running because you have a bigger message you want to bring to the Virginia Senate race?
Well, if I decided to run, it would be because I think I have something to say and something to contribute. I also think it's important to remember that Hillary Clinton proved that just being against Donald Trump isn't a winning message. It's not a winning strategy. And so Democrats can gin up anti-Trump sentiment all they want, but unless they are responding to the problems in people's lives, they're not going to win. And right now, if I were a Democrat in that party, I'd be saying, as many Democrats are, get off bashing Trump and get back on making people's lives better, because that's where Hillary Clinton lost. She couldn't articulate how she was going to make people's lives better.
Since you are our first presidential candidate, I want to ask you a question. What did you learn about yourself during the arduous process of seeking the Republican president? That's a hard job. That's a hard thing to do. What did you learn about Carly Fiorina that you might not have known before you started that endeavor?
It is a hard job. I've had other hard jobs
yes,
as well.
Obviously.
But look, I loved campaigning. I learned that before in California. But yes, a presidential campaign is arduous.
Did you think you were a better candidate a second time around?
Oh, for sure. For sure. It was a great adventure and a great privilege. Yes, you know, I started with 3% name ID and no fundraising apparatus or political infrastructure. And so we didn't have a lot of money, although we did pretty well raising, considering everything. But that meant lots of bad hotels and lots of really bad food and, you know, long nights and vans and all the rest of it. So it's a drain. But on the other hand, I wouldn't trade a minute of the opportunity to meet so many incredible people, to see so much of this country. And one of the things that I'm struck by is how too many Americans feel helpless and powerless. And I think that is a huge issue, and it's why we need to restore power and money where it belongs in communities and families and states. But I was also struck with the generosity of people. I'm a cancer survivor. We lost a daughter to addictions. And everywhere I went, people would come up to me and share their personal stories, either of battling a disease or losing a loved one. And I thought how generous that was. They were trying to reach out to me and saying, you're not alone, and we appreciate what you went through, and I'm going through it too.
You talked about how voters felt and maybe still do feel powerless. I want to take that thought, because I heard that a lot from Trump supporters I met at more than 75 rallies across the country during the campaign. And I also am recalling something you were asked in 2008 when you were a surrogate for John McCain. You were asked, could Sarah Palin or John McCain be a CEO? And you said, no. And neither could Barack Obama or Joe Biden. And that generated some degree of publicity that was not helpful for John McCain and Sarah Palin. But your larger point,
the media ignored that I said it about Obama and Biden.
But your larger point was the political class, as it was structured, isn't oriented toward running a business. Now we have someone oriented toward business sitting at the top of the American government. Do you think in your own heart that that's going to be a net advantage for this country and for President Trump? Or are you reevaluating the sense that someone who can be an effective CEO or business leader can also be an effective political figure and president of the United States?
I think it's a net benefit that he's not been in politics. Ours was intended to be a citizen government. You have to remember that to become a chief executive of business, you have to have a fair amount of technical training. Just like, as I said at the time, you know, I couldn't be a jet fighter pilot either. There's a certain amount of training. Is there expertise that someone needs to understand how the federal government works? Yes, absolutely. But on the other hand, what do you learn running a business? you learn that if you give an organization too much money and too much power, the power will be abused and the money will be wasted. What do you learn running a business? That actually how you spend every dime matters. What professional politicians have wanted to say to the American people, this is such a specialized role, nobody but us can do it. It's not true. The truth is there are hugely helpful experiences outside of politics that make people better at politics. And one of the things that I'm encouraged by, frankly, is now you see more and more people, whether they have a military background or a business background or a nonprofit background, the guy in Georgia who ran the Democrat ran, he was a documentary filmmaker. Great. Ours was intended to be a citizen government of, by, and for the people, and we were never intended to have a professional political class, which is what we've got.
So when you see an issue like, and we're going to have to wrap up here in just a second, but I want to talk to you about this because it struck me last week as something possibly significant. During the campaign, not only you, but Donald Trump and others said, you know, the Ex-Im Import Bank is kind of a feather bedding operation. It's a little too cozy with CEOs in corporate America. Sarah Palin has called it, and I think would call it again, crony capitalism. The president was very much against it, said he's going to get rid of it. Tells the Wall Street Journal last week, you know what, it's really a good program. Helps a lot of people out. I think we're going to keep it. Did that alarm you?
Well, I think it was clearly a reversal. And here's the thing about Washington. Does the Export-Import Bank do some good? Yes, it does. Is it a program that has been appropriately gigged for corruption? Yes, it has. Here's the thing. Washington is an extremely complex set of interests. The tax code, the regulatory structure, how Ex-Im Bank, pick your example. That complexity always favors big companies over small companies. It favors wealthy, well-connected, powerful individuals over powerless and nameless individuals. That's why money and power have to leave Washington ultimately. Complexity favors the big, the powerful, the wealthy, and the well-connected. And Ex-Im Bank does too. Does it occasionally do good for smaller businesses? Yes, but mostly it does good for bigger businesses. And so,
is that a telling reversal for this president, in your opinion?
Well, possibly. Possibly. And I think, honestly, all the advisors who come from Goldman Sachs is, it gives me pause for concern. Crony capitalism is alive and well. Complexity has to be gotten rid of because as long as this reform tax code and regulatory structure so complicated, the big are advantaged always over the small.
That's the voice of Carly Fiorina, our very first presidential candidate at the Takeout Podcast. She will not be the only one, I guarantee you. There'll be more in the future because this conversation is always about politics, policy, and the intersection between the two, and lots of other cool topics. And we'll get to those with our guest, Carly Fiorina, in that Takeout Outtake Especial, so make sure you're listening for that on Tuesday. As you well know and are fans of, episodes of The Takeout are available every Friday morning, and we invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Now, iTunes has changed its name to Apple Podcasts, so Steve, we make allowances for that as well. Please go to thetakeoutpodcast.com, follow us and like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. That's at Takeout Podcast, at takeoutpodcast.com. I'm Major Garrett, joined as always by the world's greatest takeout, no, podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris.
And the greatest takeout podcast
yes,
sidekick.
Yes, exactly.
Thank
Steve
you, Major.
Shigaris, thank you for joining us. We've been at Station 4, an excellent restaurant, which I highly recommend. Near the waterfront of Washington, D.C., Carly Fiorina has been our guest. You've been listening to The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
Where did you get them? Where did you get them?